Well, it is true that Moses turned the River Nile into blood and that Jesus turned water into wine. I am here to bear witness that this afternoon, Matt Humphrey turned one butternut squash into lunch for an entire living room of us. True story. You need to get this recipe. Roxy's sitting up here saying, yeah, he does that every day. He does something like that every day. It's great to be with you. Lindsay and I live in southeast Michigan, just outside of Detroit. And we have been in Oregon for the last week or week and a half through Seattle. And we took the ferry over yesterday. So it's great to see sunshine. It's a beautiful thing. Theologian Kelly Brown Douglas explains that when the earliest slaves in America listened to the reading of the Bible, they heard the voice of the great high God, the free, sovereign divinity they knew well from their African heritage. This was the creator God who was far greater than humans and all the lesser gods in the universe. This is the God defined by steadfast love in our psalm this morning. In this higher power, there is refuge and abundance, feasting and drinking from the river of delight. In her book, The Black Christ, Brown Douglas proposes that the best portrayals of Christ in our world are in the faces of black women, especially those living below the poverty line. She calls these women's icons of Christ, from the Greek word for image, used for centuries by the church to make God, the God of steadfast love, real and tangible in our worship. Icons spark our spiritual and theological imaginations. The divine comes to life. They are sources of encouragement and challenge, creativity, and accountability for the faithful. Brown Douglas writes, "It is only in a commitment to ensure the life and wholeness for the least of these that we can grasp the radicality of who Christ is." In contrast, the icons of the colonial script, the celebrities and the politicians and the professional religionists, wealthy white men, are the default for all of us living in North America. They serve as mirrors, shaping us in destructive and dehumanizing ways. I've come to the realization that I desperately need new icons, images that more faithfully illuminate the risen Christ in my own context. This challenges me to flip the script, just like Jesus did. So I start here because, first of all, we've got to start somewhere. And second of all, because this long weekend marks a federal holiday down in the States to honor the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in an era when the median black household wealth is about $1,700 American dollars and falling, while the median white wealth sits at over $116,000. Versus 116,000. And third, because Lindsay and I have been living and working in southeast Michigan for the last 4.5 years, taking cues from black women who are organizing for clean and affordable water in the city. An episode about wine and water, a woman and servants, is a gift for those of us being rearranged by what is bubbling up from down below. The Bible scholar Walter Brueggemann points out that in the Hebrew Bible, the three money crops, wine, oil, and grain, serve as a contrast for the widow, the orphan, and the immigrant. The litmus test for justice was ensuring that these come together, that the wine and the oil and the grain are enjoyed by the widow and the orphan and the immigrant. that workers enjoy the fruit of their labor. In Egypt, they did not. In the promised land, they always should. And so our gospel episode redirects the narrative away from the wedding celebration itself to the real action. What's happening behind the scenes? It pulls back the curtain and unveils the backstory, the real story. In Detroit, businessmen and politicians and media outlets are touting a comeback, perhaps you've heard. One of our mentors, Monica Lewis Patrick, an icon of Christ, calls the comeback nothing less than a collaborative, well-orchestrated system of evil. While the state of Michigan bestows hundreds of millions of dollars in subsidies to billionaires, building stadiums and rehabbing skyscrapers, they are foreclosing on residents who cannot afford property taxes. Business leaders and politicians transferred hundreds of millions of federal dollars away from mortgage relief towards blight removal, clearing out poor folks to make room for more development. Wedged in the Great Lakes region, bursting with more than 20% of the world's fresh water, the city is shutting off water to tens of thousands of occupied homes because these residents cannot afford the high rates. In Flint, just about an hour north, the water was poisoned after switching the source to the Flint River, a decision directly tied to campaign contributions from corporations seeking rich government contracts to build a new water pipeline to Lake Huron. Meanwhile, 2 hours north of that, Michigan sold a $200 annual permit to Nestle to allow the multinational corporation to pump 400 gallons a minute out of the ground to bottle it and sell it for massive profits. In our gospel episode, Jesus commands the servants to fill the jars with water. In Detroit, a city councilwoman cynically proclaimed publicly that if folks don't pay their water bills, they should bring their buckets to the river to get it for themselves. Instead, shut-off residents in Detroit, a supermajority of them poor black women, are hauling their jars and buckets to homes of compassionate neighbors who allow them to fill up every day. Jesus commanded the servants to take a sample and have it tested by the chief steward. In Flint, after repeated denials from city and state officials, on-the-ground resident activists and others like Flintstones' Claire McClinton and Nikea Wakes, icons of Christ, organized and recruited water engineers from Virginia Tech to test the water independently. These chief stewards of water announced that Flint residents knew long ago the water was tainted with high amounts of lead and bacteria. Only their tireless work behind the scenes made it possible to overturn official proclamations from the powerful. The chief steward in the gospel episode also had positive test results to announce. But this was imminently good news. Everyone serves the good wine first and then the inferior wine after the guests have become drunk. But you have kept the good wine until now. This is the punchline of the narrative. It is what the whole story is about. Lindsay recently shared with me her struggle in the morning when she's journaling with pen and paper, that sometimes she can't quite get to her feelings because she lacks the emoji that she has on her phone. You know, how do you draw the heart eyes or the fire? This is a gospel episode that needs an emoji after the chief steward expresses this good news to really get to that feeling. But here's the rub. Our hope comes from a God of steadfast love who will save the best for last and who will do it through those that we least expect. Along with the woman and the servants, we readers of the gospel episode share the vital knowledge about where the good wine actually comes from. The chief steward's punchline challenges us to pull back the curtain and go behind the scenes of every comeback story. Because when capitalism serves up a comeback, there is always a widow, an orphan, or an immigrant carrying the water behind the scenes. The radical Christian hope is that there is good wine fermented over the centuries by ancient prophetic wisdom. This is what the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. called a radical revolution of values. The shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. From a thing-oriented society, wine, oil, grain, to a person-oriented society, the widow, the orphan, the immigrant. Dr. King consistently told audiences that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. In the meantime, we need a 12-step recovery from the inferior wine that we are addicted to, what King called the giant triplets of evil: racism, militarism, and materialism. The challenge for those, like many of us, with privilege and opportunity, is to pull back the curtain and follow those who are fermenting the good wine. It was behind the scenes at organizing meetings in Detroit where Lindsay and I found Maureen Taylor, precious icon of Christ, the executive director of Michigan Welfare Rights. In one of our first encounters with her, she had a confession for a few dozen of us that were resisting water shutoffs in Detroit. She mailed a package of Spanish onions to Governor Rick Snyder, who had been evading and denying Michigan's water injustice for years. She attached a note to this package urging him to slice one of them if he needed help crying for the victims of poisoned and shut off water. I propose that we celebrate the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Day in a subversive and creative spirit, just like Maureen Taylor, whose tender compassion and fierce conviction continues to inspire us. The rest of the world is waiting for followers of Dr. King and followers of King Jesus to fulfill their dreams with a lifestyle that is intoxicating. And people are waiting for an embodied apologetic to prove that the God of steadfast love is alive and on the move by living steadfast love in real time. This is the kind of evangelism that my Al-Anon fellows call attraction, not promotion. I'd like to end by going back to the beginning of the episode, an obvious allusion to resurrection. On the third day, there was a wedding. Resurrection is like a wedding where all the real action is behind the scenes. The real actors are those Jesus called in another gospel the least of these. Our trip up here to Victoria is a little bit of a homecoming for me. Way back in 1906, my great-grandfather Tom, who I'm named after, he and his wife Mary and their three sons moved here from the United Kingdom to work in the coal mines just about 100 kilometers north of here. And they were here for just about 2 years. My great uncle Phil was born here, and they ended up moving to central Washington. And what the family narrative has been passed down, they moved onto old sagebrush land. Omak, Washington. What I later learned though, was that just a few years before great-grandfather Tom and Mary and their four sons moved there, the indigenous folk there, the Okanagan, were moved into a reserve on the other side of the river. And so I'm trying to get back to the indigenous, and I'm trying to get back to the African-American history that is there to get to the truth, to connect the dots, and to tell the truth. In his final sermon just a few days before his assassination, Dr. King contrasted the intergenerational story of my family with his. The federal government simply said, "You're free." And it left him there penniless, illiterate, not knowing what to do. And the irony of it all is that at the same time the nation failed to do anything for the black man, through an act of Congress, it was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. So the truths of my family tree and of my nation's history call me to a ministry of fermentation. These powerfully subvert the success stories that I've been told and assumed. They help me connect the dots and tell the truth. They help me practice resurrection, carrying the water with the widow, the orphan, and the immigrant, behind the scenes where the good wine is fermenting. Amen.